with Stark. He's a sickness.
Ah, Junior.
You're gonna break your old man's heart.
If I have to.
Nobody has to break anything.
Clearly, you've never made an omelet.
You beat me by 1 second.
Ah, this is funny, Mr. Stark. It's what, comfortable? Like old times?
This was never my life.
You two can still walk away from this.
No, we will.
You believe in peace, then let us keep it.
I think you're confusing peace with quiet.
Yeah, huh? What's the vibranium for?
I'm glad you asked that, because I wanted to take this time to explain my evil plan.
One would have to be blind, deaf, dumb, and living under the proverbial rock to not recognize that bit of early summer movie mayhem as being from Marvel Studios' Avengers: Age of Ultron, opening this weekend at theaters across North America. Projected by industry prognosticators such as Box Office Magazine and the global financial services firm The Cohen Group to exceed the $207 million opening 3-day take of its 2012 predecessor, Age of Ultron has already done that overseas, with its debut last weekend in 26 other territories and smashing box office records in China, Russia, and the Philippines, to name but a few.
And while Marvel is certainly under the spotlight right now with its new Avengers and the unparalleled buzz of July's upcoming Ant-Man, the ages-old friendly crosstown rivalry with publishing and now filmic competitor DC Comics has never been more intense. With next summer's Batman vs. Superman, Dawn of Justice, and Suicide Squad, which is sort of a Dirty Dozen-like assemblage of legendary villains from Gotham and Metropolis, already generating the kind of online publicity that multi-million dollar budgets couldn't buy.
But how in the living hell did this happen? How did comic book adaptations become all the rage in the last decade? As many of us, shall we say over 30-ers, remember the high and dry mid-1990s, but not only was DC pulling marketing stunts like marrying off then killing its most legendary character, Superman,
but even mighty Marvel Publications went bankrupt, selling and licensing off its properties for grade Z films such as the mercifully forgotten Captain America from Sword and the Sorcerer director Albert Pune, TV's Nick Fury starring David Hasselhoff, and Roger Corman's 1994 Less Than Fantastic Four, which audiences were never ever meant to see.
Using Age of Ultron as a springboard, for the next hour or so, we're going to high dive into the fascinating, sometimes amazing, sometimes effed up world of comic book to film adaptations.
Pull out your dusty dog-eared copies of books like Watchmen, 300, Judge Dredd, and even Road to Perdition off the shelves, as we're getting into all of them with our special guests, popular comic book illustrator Adam Hughes, and film producer Steve Wegner.
I'm Craig Jameson of Gull Cottage Online.
And I'm Jim Delaney of TheLunchMovie.com.
And welcome to an all-new season of The Grindhouse with our special episode, Comic Books to Film.
Watching people pay for our mistakes.
Isn't why we fight so we can end the fight and go home?
Well, you amazingly failed.
here we all are. With nothing but our wit and our will to save the world. So stand and fight.
No way we all get through this.
I got no plans tomorrow night.
I'm always picking up after you boys.
We can tear them apart. From the inside.
That's the best you can do!
Gotta ask.
Everyone, welcome back to an all-new season of The Grindhouse. It's been 10 months since our last episode, the Field of Dreams 25th anniversary show, where we had 12 different guys chime in on why that film means so much to them after all these years. It was a great show, very, very popular, but man, it was a bitch to edit. But it did touch a lot of people, especially those who participated. So thanks once again for all those guys for putting their heart out there. So, Jim, in the past 10 months, what have you been up to?
Well, you know, for the previous 10 months or so, I've been really bad about seeing in movies. And lately, I've been getting back into that swing. You know, it's like the movie perception muscle has been kind of atrophied. And it's been flexing a lot, you know, especially in the, you know, the 5 or 6 months. And it feels good to go to festivals again, you know. And other than that, also kind of rededicating myself to the original purpose of Launch Movie. You know, it started with watching movies in a conference room in my old job, and we've been doing more and more of it in the conference room in my current job. Not quite as often as I was able to, you know, every day in the old place, but here still Mondays and Fridays. You know, we start something on Friday, finish it on a Monday, and draw a good crowd, and looking forward to getting, you know, more and more chances with it.
To any first-time listeners who may not be aware, I'm here in Philadelphia. That's my here. But when you refer to your here, you are referring to...
Emerson College in Boston, Massachusetts. And apparently Emerson College now in Sunset Boulevard in Los Angeles, too. But they don't have my conference room gig because they're just not that cool yet.
There you go. Very cool. On this end, we've been finishing up the documentary film, Steve Burtley, The Man Who Saved the Movies, is coming along nicely. Not easy, but coming along nicely. We've got a little more filming to do in New York this summer, a little more studio work here in Philadelphia, and we'll start hitting the festival circuit this fall. Our mini online network, Creative TV, starts later this summer. That'll be really cool. We've got a slate of 5 mini online shows coming up there.
Let me in. Let me in.
Oh, that would be Poltergeist 2's villainous Reverend Kane letting us know that the first of our guests has arrived. We certainly don't want to piss off the Reverend Kane now, do we? Coming up in a few, we have illustrator Adam Hughes joining us. And those who are fans of comic book art, hell, those who are just fans of art know the name Adam Hughes, as he's become one of the most popular illustrators in the country over the past 20 years, doing everything from DC's Wonder Woman covers to Catwoman to Star Trek graphic novel Roll of Honor to most recently J. Michael Straczynski's contribution to the Before Watchmen series, Adam doing the Dr. Manhattan covers. Me personally, I've known the name Adam Hughes for about 30 years. Yeah. I'm that old, and I've got the lower back indies to prove it. Probably one of one or two friends since childhood. I love Adam. He's a fighter. He's opinionated every bit as much as I am, and that's probably why we're still friends after all these years, because we respect one another's opinions. But as I kind of got out of comic books in the 80s and kind of started slanting more towards film screenwriting, the past 20 years of comic book development, I know everything from Adam. He's the one who keeps me up to date, who lets me know what's happening and what's changing and what new trends are going on, for better and for worse. So Adam will be joining us in a few.
Looking forward to that. And we've also got producer Steve Wegner, who has, well, not produced any comic book films, but he's produced from just about every genre beyond that. He's done thrillers like The Book of Eli and Insomnia. He's done family films like Dolphin Tale 1 and 2. He's done my personal favorite movie of 2013, Prisoners, which took a man well known to comic fans, Hugh Jackman, and gave him a very un-Wolverine-like role that I think rattled a few people as far as, you know, if they were expecting Hugh Jackman to be their standard hero. He's also done the Oscar-winning The Blind Side and One Missed Call and several other films, and he's got a lot more in the pipeline right now.
In addition to Steve and Adam, we've got quite a bit packed into our season opener tonight. We've got a Kenya Diggett review of Avengers: Age of Ultron. We're dipping into the Gold Cottage Grindhouse archives to retrieve a handful of our rare interviews for the creators of some of the all-time most popular comics to film. We've got a collection of interstitials, if you will, shorts delving into a little behind-the-scenes info about those films. And during our chat today, you may even notice a soundtrack of sorts in the background, spinning a few tunes from some of those cinema gems. So without further ado, let's get Steve in here and get this bad boy in gear.
Hey, man, you there?
Yep.
How goes it, dude?
it goes well. How are you?
Welcome, sir. Great to have you here.
Hi, Steve. Okay. How are you?
I'm good, thank you.
So I'm curious. Now, have you guys met before? I know that you both know Bob. And he said that you were not necessarily the world's biggest comic fan growing up, so that you might not have points of reference on minute little details that rabid comic book fans might have.
That is correct.
And I said, that's great, because I guess you could just speak, Adam would basically speak as a rabid comic fan, being an illustrator,
right.
And then we could have you just speak from the filmmaking point of view.
I'm a rabid film fan, so...
Exactly. but I have to say, one of the things...
comics.
Okay, well, one of the things I thought was very cool, I remember a couple of years back when we spoke, and you mentioned how you had done your college thesis on The Hitcher.
Yes.
And how... go ahead, please.
Yeah, it's a horror film, right? So it's a horror film that takes place in wide open spaces in broad daylight, which is the opposite of a typical horror film of dark, enclosed space.
Exactly.
That was my paper out of high school for USC. Yeah.
Oh, excellent. So just based on that, I thought, wow, that's awesome. I mean, obviously, he's, you know, not the stereotypical exec sitting there with his feet up on the desk and a big giant cigar, you know, with angels dropping grapes in his mouth. You know, he's got a little
background. And also, extension to that story is actually a film I did called Insomnia related to The Hitcher, because Insomnia is basically film blanc, right? So it's film noir set in broad daylight because it never gets dark. So those films are connected in my background, too. So it's kind
awesome.
Of ironic.
I never thought of that. I never thought about that connection. Yeah, that's pretty awesome. You're absolutely right. Now,
that makes you want to watch them as a double feature.
Utah, give me two.
Exactly. So I guess we'll jump right in and just ask your opinion. Jim and I were talking before you called in about, you know, some of the things that we like about the whole new trend in comic books. Jim was very thrilled by the fact that it's been so successful that now we're actually getting into more obscure characters like Ant-Man, or even Guardians of the Galaxy, that the rest of the world may not have known but are being introduced to now, which is great. I had said one of the things I was thrilled about was how, as a child, I read comic books, but now we're at a phase where film technology actually allows us to realize these stories outside of the realm of traditional animation. Mm-hmm. Now, we also asked, what are you concerned about? Jim's concern was how a lot of rabid fans might be so rabid that they kind of jump the gun as soon as they see a leaked photo or something. They're immediately saying how terrible this movie's going to be, and they start bad-mouthing it. My concern was, because it's so successful a trend right now, do you think it runs the risk of burning itself out within the next 2 or 3 years?
Well, yes. For me personally, it's already burned itself out, because superheroes, I'm kind of tired of them, to be honest. I mean, Ant-Man and Guardians, notwithstanding, those actually are kind of unique. So those are different. But these, your typical, you know, origin story superhero, the mask, all that stuff. I mean, I'm tired of it. And so I'm a fan of more grounded, reality-based action movie.
Okay.
But, you know, that's just me.
Okay. Well, kind of far as it, please, go ahead.
I was about to say, kind of a neat thing there is that, I mean, there are more graphic novels than comic books that also kind of touch on that area. And I would say, you know, a movie like The History of Violence that a lot of people don't even know came from
I love History of Violence. But have you guys read the screenplay before Cronenberg got involved?
No.
It is pulp junk. I mean, it's not good.
Wow. Okay.
It's a typical 80s Seagal action movie with the concept of a guy hiding out. Now, when Cronenberg came in, he rewrote the whole script, and he made it unique. And by the way, he didn't even know it was based on a graphic novel himself until after the fact.
That'd be a good thing.
So, and also the writer of that script got an Oscar nomination.
And that's
I'm telling you, that script was not good, because I read that script as a spec when it came out. And I go, this is just, you know. But Cronenberg saw the concept that was interesting to him, and he rebuilt it.
Well, it's funny, you should mention Cronenberg, because Jim and I were talking earlier about one of Stephen King's own personal favorite adaptations of his own work is The Dead Zone. And how, strictly speaking, I believe Stephen King did a version of the screenplay ahead of, and it was like an encyclopedia. And again, Cronenberg basically chucked out the whole first half of the book and just decided to focus on the Johnny Smith character and do his sort of Shakespearean tragedy by way of Norman Rockwell.
Exactly. If you read Cronenberg's script, they're extremely concise. A script of his literally will be a 3-act script. The 69, 70, 71, 75 pages.
Good Lord.
I mean, they're lean and mean. Basically, he knows what he wants.
Mm-hmm.
He's not going overboard in description, but they're very succinct and good. I mean, obviously, he's one of my favorite filmmakers.
Yeah, same here. Big time.
Spartans! Ready your breakfast and eat hearty. For tonight, we dine in hell!
Thundering into theaters and catching the world by storm in March 2006, 300, a fictionalized retelling of history's legendary Battle of Thermopylae, became one of the most popular, controversial, and trend-setting comic book adaptations of all time in its reimagining of the legend of Grecian King Leonidas, who leads 300 crack Spartan soldiers against a 300,000-strong invading Persian army. Based on the acclaimed 1998 graphic novel by writer Frank Miller and artist Lynn Varley, 300's director, Zack Snyder, would use a stylized superimposition filmic technique to near perfectly capture the tone and color palette of the book, and to provide a sense of latitude in allowing the story to be realized as a more energetic pulp fantasy adventure than literal history. This visual technique would go on to influence an entire decade of similarly themed and epically scaled action adventures.
Words came as a result of pictures. It's a tradition that's long and proud. And it's only really been in the past few centuries that people have separated reading and drawing from each other. Comic books are a wonderful way to reunite the two. Now, we see that happening all over our media. Surely television and film are a mixture of the two, as are music videos and games.
And it is its own medium. You can't get the same reaction from watching a film that you do from reading a comic, and you're not going to get the same reaction reading a book as when you do. A comic is totally unique experience because it's allowing you to participate and for you to fill in those scenes in between the gutters, in between each panel. He was inspired by this old film. I think Jeffrey Hunter was in it back in the 60s, and it was not a very good film, but it you know, he was a young kid and it knocked him back. He couldn't believe it.
My whole sense of what a hero was changed. A hero was no longer the guy who got the badge or got cheered like Harry Potter at the end of every story. A hero was somebody who did something because he was right and whose gains might happen far beyond his death, and mainly who is willing to die uncredited and forgotten.
Now, as far as the... I was reading an article earlier as far as the foreign distribution of various films, and I guess it's not just limited to comic book adaptations. I mean, nowadays, I mean, I remember 10, 15 years ago, you would get most of your money, most of your profit from America, and then you would maybe have 30, 40% from overseas. Nowadays, it seems to be the exact opposite, if not even more imbalanced. So you have a movie like, say, forget for saying, Battleship, which makes, you know, $300 million thereabouts, only $65 million of which was from the U.S., or even something like Roland Emmerich's Godzilla, which I have a personal soft spot for. I know the whole world hates it. But, you know, that made like $380 million worldwide and about $136 from the U.S., which is kind of funny perception. Most people still perceive that movie as a bomb. Now,
well,
I wouldn't call it...
That goes back to Waterworld. Waterworld is perceived a bomb, but it was quite the opposite.
Right. And so as far as the whole international distribution thing, I was reading an article about Iron Man 3, not my favorite of the Iron Man series. I'm not a big fan. I can't stand that film. And I was reading about the Chinese version, where there's like 4 or 5 minutes of extra footage with a character named Dr. Wu, which even the Chinese audiences hated it because it was a very obvious attempt to just, you know, get a little financing from the Chinese government. So they put a couple of Chinese actors in it. It was a subplot about Tony Stark getting some shrapnel removed from his heart and this Dr. Wu performing the operation, which had absolutely nothing to do with anything in the story. But, you know, they were able to run some ads, some promotional stuff with Tony Stark drinking this Chinese milk on TV and before the movie, so they got a few million dollars to add to the budget, much to the consternation of people in China. And I guess the footage was so horrible, it doesn't even show up on the U.S. DVDs or Blu-rays or anything like that. But, I don't know, do you see this as being more commonplace? I kind of wanted to get Adam to chime in on that, because he and I had a big disagreement about Captain America.
I mean, China is such a huge territory, right? So, but remember, the U.S. is only getting like 20% of the profits. But the territory has been absent for so long, it didn't exist before, that that's a huge number even of itself.
Yeah.
And it tells you somebody in China is making a freaking fortune on these movies they're releasing there. Because they're getting the other 80%. It's mind-boggling.
Yeah, wow.
So at some point, it has to shift back to a more even playing field of profits, of the studios participating in the profits. For that territory.
How so? Could you explain that a little bit?
Well,
people who might not know that terminology.
The rest of the world, their cut is a much, much, much larger.
Okay.
So, but they're so desperate to get into China, they made it's a bad deal. If you make something and you only get a small fraction of the profit, and the other side profits 80% more than you, that's something wrong.
It's called loan sharking in South Philly.
Right, exactly.
Right, you know.
But so right now it's okay because that territory is so big and it was never there before. It's all found money in essence.
So do you
is that pretty much the straight across the board deal, or is it different for movie to movie or studio to studio?
It's a Hollywood film that you get into China. If you do a co-production, which Iron Man 3 is trying to do, is get a co-production basis where you get a bigger cut. I believe it's closer to 40%. If you're a Chinese American co-production per se.
Do you now? Obviously, there's some stuff you might not be able to talk about, but do you see this as becoming more of a trend as China opens up as a major market to Western films?
The trend to, what's the question
to,
exactly?
Well, enter into more equitable co-production deals. Do you think that American studios will be able to do that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, everybody wants a piece of that pie.
Okay.
Because you can essentially have a movie that is big in China and nowhere else in the world, and you're in profit because mm-hmm. it's a territory that's equal or larger to the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a lot of money. But on the other side of the coin, you need films that travel there, right? So it's definitely, that's why superhero films are so popular, because they travel everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
So the upside's huge. So I mean, that's because the foreign market now, even on, we have Fear of Seven's 300 currently domestic. It's already over $1 billion in 3 weeks.
That's pretty amazing. Yeah.
It's incredible. So right now, it was basically a day and date opening across the world. 700 million international, 300 domestic, right now, and then building.
Wow. Now, Adam and I actually had a little bit of disagreement a couple of years back on the first Captain America film. We both really loved the film. In fact, mm-hmm. Captain America was the character that actually inspired him to enter the comic book business as a child. And
I'm a big fan of Rocketeer, by the way. I love Rocketeer.
Me too.
So,
absolutely.
Same director. Yeah.
I love the Rocketeer. Yeah. Definitely, that would fall
into
the category.
That's one of my favorites, actually. That's up there.
Me too.
Top 10 of a comic book movie, for sure.
Me too. It kind of falls into my category of one of the most woefully underrated films, too, in cinema history. Now, the disagreement we had, when he first started seeing some of the first trailers for Captain America, he feared, and he used the George C. Scott patent phrase, that the film would do the denazification of Captain America. And I understood where he was coming from. It's kind of like how every now and then a story where, for example, in the novel Patriot Games, the guys who were coming after Jack Ryan, they were the IRA. In the film version, mm-hmm. they kind of temper that a little bit, and you have an offshoot of the IRA. You know, these guys
exactly.
are so radical.
They're a bastardized version.
Right, the IRA have even turned their backs on them, you know, and maybe they're even coming after them, you know, so as not to offend anyone overseas. Adam feared that's what would happen with Captain America, where the Nazis would pretty much be replaced by Hydra, which essentially mm-hmm. is what happens. And I said, yeah, I understand where you're coming from, because if you remove the reason that a character exists, for example, Spider-Man doesn't really exist because he was bitten by a radioactive spider. He exists because he had a chance to stop a robbery. He didn't. And then that guy killed his uncle, and he's trying to do retribution, you know.
Right.
You know, same thing with Batman. He's not a hero because he's rich. It helps. He's a hero. He does what he does as sort of like symbolic vengeance for all those who, you know, can't stand up. So with Captain America, he was created to fight the Nazis. So I understand where he's coming from. However, I said, you know, Adam, you know, films nowadays make a lot more of their money overseas, and especially in Europe, it's actually illegal to show Nazi symbols in some of these countries. So you can't really have mm-hmm. a movie filled with swastikas and Nazis going Sieg Heil. So we had this long disagreement that led to him. I just said, hey, dude, why don't you just write a guest blog on my website? And he did. And it's actually still very popular today. It's called All This and World War II, T-O-O, you know, but where he goes into detail about why he felt it was all about trying to sell toys, you know. And so we still disagree on that. We still both love the film, and we're both even more the Winter Soldier, because they just knocked it out of the park with that one. But
What about the fact that they changed the title to First Avenger overseas to downplay the American?
Yeah, exactly. That too. yeah, I mean, that was pretty obvious.
The same argument.
Exactly, yeah. So, and personally, I didn't have a problem with that. You know, then again,
In Germany, Austria is a big territory.
Right, exactly. So you can't go pissing off Germans. I was working in a restaurant years ago, and a guy came in, and he was entertaining some business guests. They had not yet arrived. He was a little nervous, so he had a drink or two, which turned into three and four. And by the time his guests arrived, he was feeling no pain, we'll say. His guests were a group of Japanese businessmen, and he thought he was being endearing. I don't know why he thought this. He was talking about World War II, and yeah, and he wasn't, you know, deliberately trying to be offensive, but it's like, dude, you don't talk about World War II in front of a bunch of Japanese businessmen and think you're impressing them by how open-minded you're being. Anyway, these guys were extremely embarrassed for him, and I always thought, my God, I would love to be a fly on the wall to see what he felt or thought when he woke up in the morning and looked in the mirror.
Yeah.
And well, so similarly,
when I meet German people, I definitely don't ask questions just meeting them, but if I get friendly with them fairly close, I ask questions about their thoughts on World War II and Nazism, mm-hmm. and how it affects their lives, because their grandparents were there or around. So it's interesting to think about asking a Japanese person that same question. Because, I mean, Germans hate Nazis, too. It's not like...
Right.
They're
you would do this while sober.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So Nazis are an easy target to have as bad guys, because Germans hate them, too. So it's not like... Mm-hmm. But it's a sensitive aspect of their history they're very ashamed of, and...
So
it's always interesting to hear their point of view.
Big boy, ain't we pals?
No pals in this business, Lips. You taught me that. Sign it.
The deed to the Club Ritz?
That's right. I'm going into show business now. Get dirty, Lips. You need a bat.
Not the bat! Not the bat, big boy! Not the bat!
Debuting as a comic strip in the Detroit Mirror newspaper in 1931, Chester Gould, a legendary square-jawed, hard-hitting, retro high-tech police detective, Dick Tracy, became a worldwide phenomenon upon being picked up and distributed by the Chicago Tribune New York News Syndicate. Beginning as a daily radio serial in 1934, the crime-fighting super cop has rarely been absent from the multimedia arena in over 80 years. Realized also as a series of adventure record albums, film serials, cartoons, and theatrical features. Its most prestigious being 1990's A Lavishly Realized Redux, produced, directed by, and starring Warren Beatty. With an all-star cast including Al Pacino, Dustin Hoffman, William Forsythe, Glenn Headley, Dick Van Dyke, Mandy Patinkin, and Madonna, Dick Tracy would go on to receive 7 Academy Award nominations and win 3 for its highly stylized production design, best original song, and stunningly accurate according to the comic's depiction of villainous character makeup designs. In 1990, popular character actor Paul Sorvino, who portrays double-crossed mob chieftain Lips Manless, discussed the pros and cons of working beneath such heavy prosthetic appliances.
I let myself go with it. You either accept makeup or you fight it. And if you fight the makeup or you let it inhibit you, it hurts the acting. I've worn mustaches several times, and once or twice I've allowed them to stop me from working, from really doing so, because you're always afraid it's going to fall off, so you kind of end up talking like this without moving your mouth, you know? And your upper lip stays that way, and the mustache is perfect, and your acting stinks. In this case, I'm wearing this enormous prosthesis which covers my entire face in 5 pieces with this tremendous mouth. And so I sort of shaped my mouth to make it work and went with the whole thing. And it helped the character because in Dick Tracy, the characters, these wild characters are what the piece is all about. Can you imagine the greater fantasy for Warren Beatty? All the men in the picture look like monsters except him who looks like Warren Beatty.
Steve, can we shift gears real quick? I'm kind of curious after, I mean, what we were saying about overseas and whatnot too, but take a movie like yours, like Book of Eli, mm-hmm. which to me feels like it could have been from a graphic novel. It has that same kind of richness
and
look to it and everything.
Lookbook actually was a graphic novel. There's a lookbook for the movie. It's a graphic novel.
Yeah. Oh, cool.
Oh, good. Okay. Now, do you find that is easy to, I mean, not necessarily comic film, but still a genre film. Well, let's take that and say Prisoners, which, by the way, is my absolute hands-down favorite movie of 2013, and bless you even bringing that. But that has, you got a movie with a guy who's pretty well known for a comic character. Would between Book of Eli and Prisoners, is one of those an easier sell overseas or an easier sell here? I mean, both being kind of genre things, but not necessarily comic.
Eli is much more genre, so it's much easier to sell. You have a big movie star doing action, who's known for his action roles. So that's an easier sell, for sure. And Prisoners is... Well, it's, we movie's not the easy sell, and I'm not saying it's the easy sell, because it's a very dark material. But the script is so good, you attract that size cast to it. It makes it commercial. I mean, the idea of that movie opens over $20 million opening is pretty remarkable.
Yeah.
Because that goes to very dark places.
Well, I guess along similar lines, or maybe we're veering a little bit, but again, as far as selling certain things, you remember, a month or two ago, maybe 2 months ago, Michelle Rodriguez got into trouble for making a little comment about, you know, as minorities, we need to stop taking the white people superhero roles. She got a lot of flack for that. Okay? Yeah. Now, personally, if you watch the little video clip, I'm pretty sure she was hammered when she said that.
Mm-hmm.
But what's interesting...
Yeah,
People
be hammered quite frequently.
Yeah, okay. But what was interesting is, upon hearing the rest of her comment, which I kind of agree with, she said, you know, and start making our own, you know, which I could kind of agree with, you know. I think that, I mean, there's, for some reason, there was a huge uproar when Michael P. Jordan was cast as Johnny Storm in the new Fantastic film.
Really?
I remember a few years ago, a group of patriotic Americans threw a hissy fit when Idris Elba was cast as Heimdall in Thor, you know,
mm-hmm.
you know, because they were like, you know, it was Norse mythology and, you know, the whole Aryan thing. And the response was, yeah, but it's mythology, so you can do what you damn well please, you know. So, you know,
you know, but, I think that's silliness. I understand if it's based on a real person, like,
right?
You change the race, that's a problem. But otherwise, I don't see a problem whatsoever.
Let me in.
All right. If we could definitely pause for a minute, I definitely want to bring Adam in on this, as he and I, over the years, have had many conversations over what constitutes true controversy versus maybe political correctness run amok. He's been listening for a couple of minutes, and when we did a dry run the other day, there was a little, at first, slightly noticeable reverb, some kind of Skype Verizon connectivity glitch emanating from the Philly end of things. So if it happens again, I promise the listeners it'll clear up in a couple of minutes. Anyway.
How you doing, man?
How are you? I've got Jim and Steve on the other lines, so we're presently going from Philadelphia to Boston to Atlanta to L.A. Adam, meet Jim. Jim, Adam, and Steve, everybody. So along this topic, when people were going apeshit crazy when Gods and Kings was first released, I actually wrote a little posting on the Gull Cottage Facebook page talking about this and about how, kind of like what you said, if it's a real character or true character, yeah, you kind of have to be faithful to the reality of a situation. I recall reading how when Louis Gossett played Anwar Sadat in that miniseries back in the early 90s, he was nominated for an Emmy and a lot of critical acclaim. But in Egypt, mm-hmm. there was a lot of trouble about that because he was a little darker in complexion.
A little darker, yeah.
Yeah. Then and a lot of people there had a problem with that. Now, I had said, as an example, okay, let's look back at film history at very famous characters like Charlie Chan, Mr. Moto, Othello, and even Zorro. And, I mean, a lot of people don't realize the very first Latin actor to ever portray Zorro in a major film was Antonio Banderas. Up until then, you know, Guy Williams and all these other guys, and no one ever batted an eye. Right. You know, no one ever batted an eye. Look at all the guys who have played Charlie Chan or Mr. Moto. Most of them have been, you know, white guys in with prosthetics.
Mm-hmm.
And even one of the most famous characters in history, Othello, most people think of Orson Welles and you know, and Laurence Olivier and other guys in almost Jolson-like blackface.
You had Robbie Benson playing a Chicano in Walk Proud in 1979-80.
Really? I didn't know that one, you know. Wow. So Adam, you've been monitoring the last few minutes. What's your take on the whole race thing and gender thing?
As long as it works.
As long as it works, yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, these great characters who span multiple generations of fans and multiple generations of creators, you know, there's no one definitive Hamlet. Mm-hmm. And in fact, Hamlet, like Batman or what, or Doctor Who, they invite different interpretations. And one act of different interpretations is different gender, different race. You know, when we finally succeed in uplifting chimps and dolphins, different species, it was harder for people to accept somebody new as Captain Kirk, because Captain Kirk had only been played by one guy.
Yeah,
forever.
Really.
As opposed to, you could have a different actor play Batman or Spider-Man every film, and people probably wouldn't notice.
Okay, right. Because the character is so much greater than the actor, yeah.
Yeah, and because the sheer nature of the number of interpretations invites more and more diverse interpretations.
Right. James Bond, yeah. You know?
James Bond, exactly. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, I remember talking with a friend who was working, you know, they're working elbow to elbow with Madison Avenue long before the film comes out. So this buddy of mine was telling me all about Casino Royale a year before it came out. Mm-hmm.
Nice.
Because he was working with, like, you know, what watch will James Bond be promoting? Mm-hmm. What drink will James Bond – what car will James Bond be promoting? That stuff. And he was saying how terrible Casino Royale was going to be. And I said, why? He goes – he says it doesn't have the theme song. There's no quips. There's no gadgets. Blah, blah, blah. He was listing all the things. And
I love, you know, it. Yeah, me too. Yeah.
Because when you get to the very end and, you know, he shoots – was it Mr. White?
Mr. White, yeah.
And he's like, who are you? And he's like, Bond, James Bond. And they play the theme for the first time. I literally was a foot taller because I was sitting in my own poop.
Right.
And to my friend, every James Bond movie needs to have a white guy with dark hair in a tux, mm-hmm. quipping, you know, lots of gadgets that miraculously always get used but never get brought up again in a subsequent film.
Right.
He just wants the same Bond film with just different locations and different bad guys and different vaginas every time.
Right.
And I like the fact that they're going to they'll do something different. We've got a blonde James Bond. Mm-hmm. Maybe next time we'll have black James Bond, you know. I was kind of hoping at some point we'd get like a young M, where we show like a young Judy Dench running around the 70s kicking ass.
But we did get Moneypenny. Yeah.
Your Heimdall example with Idris Elba. Everybody loves Idris Elba. Yeah. You know, Idris Elba could play, you know,
James Bond.
He could play Kate Blanchett and nobody.
Right.
You know? I mean, he's one of those guys that everybody's okay with. And, you know, I remember going into Thor, I was going, oh, they're trying to do the, you know, they're trying to throw some racial diversity into an all Norse cast. Mm-hmm. Until you get there and you realize, oh, they're not going for the fact that these Asgardians are actually Norse gods. They're a race of aliens that ancient, you know, human beings worshipped as gods. You know what was a bigger race problem for me in the movie? Hogan the Grim is supposed to be a Mongol.
Ah, okay. Uh-huh.
And they hired a Japanese guy and made him like a samurai.
Okay.
And I was like going, okay, why can't he be Chinese? Why can't he be a Mongol? Mm-hmm. You know, like in the comic, why did you have to make him a samurai? And I was like, that to me was more of a, why did you do that? Mm-hmm. Then, because Heimdall was on screen for 8 seconds and I went, oh, he's so badass. He's awesome. All
right.
Kind of parallel example, when Shawshank came out, the character Red that Morgan Freeman plays in the book, that's a white mm-hmm. guy. And I remember Frank Darabont in an interview saying, you know, we read a lot of people for this. He was the personality. He was the personality of the character in the book, white or black, was Morgan Freeman. He was the only guy that felt like the guy that you read, you know, read those lines in the book. And Nick Fury, he sure as hell ain't Hasselhoff.
You think you're the only superhero in the world? Mr. Stark, you become part of a bigger universe. You just don't know it yet.
Who the hell are you?
Nick Fury, director of S.H.I.E.L.D.
Huh.
I'm here to talk to you about the Avenger Initiative.
When I was a kid, Nick Fury was a white guy running through the jungle with a whole bunch of other white guys. And then he was David Hasselhoff. And then all of a sudden, I picked up a book one day, and it's like, hey, that's me. Oh, wow. Hey, I'm Nick Fury. I look at comic books. I always see them as movies anyway. I have for a very long time. So all of a sudden, it was like, well,
I got this job. I don't have to audition. I don't have to do anything. I just got to wait on the green light to movie, and I'm in. I was, you know, all in favor of it. Plus, you know, I've always liked, you know, Nick Fury, even when he was a white guy. Like, you know, he was very cool.
Okay, me, the black guy here in the group, I'm going to play Machiavelli, or even Devil's Advocate, just for a moment, to maybe steer the conversation into a new direction. You mentioned Shawshank, and Shawshank Redemption is a very popular film now, but at the time it was released, it was not a commercial success. It took years for that film to grow in popularity via video, cable TV, and what have you. Now, I certainly don't think that it's because there was a black man in one of the lead roles. It was because it was a rather obscure story that a lot of people didn't even realize was written by Stephen King. They didn't really promote that during the film's ad campaign. But we also have, we mentioned Gods and Kings not long ago, the Ridley Scott film about Moses and Ramesses. And when it was first revealed that that film had the whitest cast, the whitest Middle Eastern cast of the biblical epic sets, the Ten Commandments, there was a bit of an uproar by people saying, oh, come on, Ridley, you couldn't have found a darker complexioned actor to portray Ramesses. And Ridley Scott's response in the press was, well, the hard and cruel facts are, if I had cast, and he said, Muhammad so-and-so in the role, I probably would not have been able to get funding. Do you think that's accurate? Does that fly? Or has Ridley just been sipping the Kool-Aid?
That comes up all the time, by the way, that, you know, black films don't travel. Which is, because even Denzel Washington's a huge movie star.
Uh-huh.
But his international is a little soft, given Tom Cruise, for example.
Uh-huh. Right. Big international, yeah.
So it's interesting. But then again, Will Smith became, I guess not anymore, but was the biggest star in the world for a spell, too. Uh-huh. So he transcended it. If you have an overly African-American cast, so it's deemed a black movie,
it
doesn't play foreign.
Mm-hmm. I would suspect that Will Smith thing probably had a lot to do with him being a popular musician, too, because music seems to travel a lot better and easier, regardless of ethnicity, than film does. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. And by the way, there's a movie where Joel Grey is playing an Asian character.
Remo Williams, yeah, where he plays Shun.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's the last time I remember that happening, but that was not that long ago.
Yeah, and he's actually really good in the role. However,
he
got a lot of flack for it. So, I kind of wonder. Yeah, nowadays we have, I thought one of the best versions of Othello, or two of the best versions, are the one with Lawrence Fishburne as Othello and Kenneth Branagh as Iago.
Oh, yeah.
That's freaking awesome. And I really dug Tim Blake Nelson's which sets the story in a contemporary high school.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and
that
in that
good.
One.
That was good.
Yeah, Mackay Pfeiffer is O, and Kristen Stewart, I think. Is it Kristen Stewart or the other girl that I get the two of them mixed up?
Kristen Stewart would be too young at the time. It would be...
Okay.
I'm forgetting.
Oh, man. I keep forgetting. Oh, man. My mind's... Oh, man. My mind's going blank. But you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
And
IMDb time.
But anyway.
No, I'm just saying.
Okay. But those, I thought, were fantastic renditions. So I just kind of wonder... How come when we get into the whole Michael B. Jordan is Johnny Storm thing, everyone kind of has, you know, short-term memory and doesn't think about the Othello or the Zorro scenario or the Remo Williams, the Joel Grey scenario? Nowadays...
Yeah, it's silly. Blade was a great example of an obscure character. By the way, I love Blade 2. That's my favorite.
Me too. That's my favorite of the three films.
Blade 2 is awesome. So now, the expansion of all these superheroes, we should have... Please give me some minority superheroes. I mean,
right.
Make it more interesting.
Right. Now, Marvel has a whole slew of them. They have the Falcon, Black Panther, Chinchilla, Luke Cage, and they are presently being developed in one way or another. In fact, Black Panther even had an animated series a couple of years ago.
Why are you here? There must be a reason for you to be here.
Yes. I'm here to fight for truth and justice in the American way.
You're
going to end up fighting every elected official in this country.
Sure you don't really mean that, Lois?
I don't believe this.
Lois?
Hmm?
I never lie.
Oh, just how fast do you fly, by the way?
Oh, I don't know, really. No, never actually, bothered to time myself.
No?
Say, why don't we find out?
And how do you propose we do that?
Take a ride with me?
You mean I could fly?
No, actually, I'd be handling the flying if that's okay.
This is utterly fantastic.
Oh, wait a minute. Where are you going?
Are you serious?
Sure. What's the matter? Don't you want to go? Okay. You don't need these.
I need a sweater. It must be kind of cold.
All right, you'd be warm enough. Ready?
Clark said that you're just a figment of somebody's imagination. Like Peter Pan.
Lark, who's that, your boyfriend?
Clark? Oh, Clark. No, he's nothing. He's just a...
Peter Pan, huh?
Uh-huh.
Peter Pan flew with children, Lois. In a fairy tale.
To this day, considered by many to be the first and still greatest superhero creation of all, Superman debuted in the June 1938 issue of Action Comics, later to return to its original publication name, Detective Comics, or DC. The brainchild of high school friends Jerry Siegel and Joel Shuster, Superman, also known as the Man of Steel because of his imperviousness to earthly weaponry, struck a chord with not only Depression-era America, but the world. As Kal-El, last surviving son of the doomed planet Krypton, arrives, infant Moses-like, as a child on Earth to become the ultimate immigrant who makes good and becomes a catalyst for change and justice in his newly adopted homeworld. While arguably surpassing Mickey Mouse as the world's most popular franchised licensed character in a series of radio, film, serial, TV, and other incarnations, it wasn't until 1978's Superman the Movie, produced by the Three Musketeers, Four Musketeers, Alexander and Ilya Salkind, and with an original story by the Godfathers Mario Puzo, Bonnie and Clyde's Robert Benton and David Newman, and directed by The Omen's Richard Donner, that the Man of Steel was finally taken seriously as a bona fide adult filmic property. This was largely due to the insistence of Donner and good friend, screenwriter Tom Mankiewicz of Diamonds Are Forever and Live and Let Die, and who rewrote the original Mammoth Puzo Newman Benton script, on keeping the film's proceedings as non-campy and as real-world romantic as possible.
Dick was the one who said to me, you know, if we can make the love story work, the rest of the picture is going to fall into place. And it really became what Dick would call two kids on a date. I remember intentionally writing the last line in that balcony scene. Superman looks down at her and he says,
Peter Pan flew with children, Lois, in a fairy tale.
Well, the implication being, obviously, this is real. This is not a fairy tale.
Okay, we finally come to what can arguably be considered the pièce de résistance of things. Basically, you know, kind of how you have in debates where each of the participants starts by rolling out first their couple of minute long soliloquy about their theory, how they feel about things. Each person states their case, and then kind of like a jazz kind of thing, you just go off and do your riff. At least that's what we're going to do here. So I'm going to kick it off. And kind of like what Tony Stark said, to a certain degree I'm going to stick to the cards this time, as there's a bit I want to pack into all of this. Anyway, here we go. All about the ages-old Marvel vs. DC conundrum. Call it dark versus light, Marvel versus DC. DC or not DC? That is the question. Never more pronounced than it is right now, with the film versions of the characters of both publishing houses having become some of the biggest money-making properties in recent cinematic history. Obviously, Marvel has been kicking ass with its cinematic universe, Iron Man, Cap, Thor, Avengers, Guardians, the new Daredevil, and more. And we can't forget, although many seem to choose to, DC's recent box office run with the three Christopher Nolan Dark Knight reboots, and even the two newest Superman films, Superman Returns and Man of Steel, the two collectively costing approximately $400 million and taking in over $1 billion worldwide, that qualifies as successful. However, many feel the DC films have gone too dark. This opinion given lots of fuel in recent days from some of the first looks at DC's upcoming Batman vs. Superman Dawn of Justice from 300, Watchmen, and Man of Steel director Zack Snyder, and Suicide Squad from Training Day's David Ayer.
The Richard Donner Superman is probably my favorite.
Mm-hmm.
I love how it's a fantasy story, but there's a real sense of humor to it,
mm-hmm.
which grounds it. It's not to take itself too seriously. And it's also my time in life, too. That was a big movie in my youth. So.
Gotcha.
I find the remakes terrible.
Really?
Both of them.
Okay. Why? Why?
The most recent one, the one by
Brian Singer,
it's just ripping off the first movie.
Right.
I don't understand how Kate Bosworth has a kid and she's 25 years old. It makes no sense to me.
Okay.
And then the Zack Snyder version kind of lost me. That fight scene at the end when they're killing who knows how many people in Metropolis is, I mean, Superman would try to save everybody, right?
Right.
And that's human life is a sacred to him. So him being thrown around buildings, it's ridiculous. Mm-hmm. And then again, that was so serious that I just didn't like the tone.
I'd say Superman also for the exact same reasons that you did, pretty much. And it's especially when I had the same problem with Man of Steel and with the you know, unseen collateral damage, and I pretty much thought the same thing you do. The guy we grew up with, Christopher Reeve, goes against what his dad tells him to do and turns back time to save one life.
Right. Mm-hmm.
He would save the whole world around for one woman, and this other, and now we can just destroy half a city as long as we don't actually see the faces in the building.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, and it's, and the thing is the Marvel films aren't immune to this either. I remember one of the many problems I had with Iron Man 2 was this big fight at the end at the Stark Expo,
right,
where all the mm-hmm. Army, Navy, mm-hmm. Marines, Air Force, mm-hmm. you know, Justin Hammer robot armors start attacking Iron Man. And I'm sitting there going, Iron Man, why are you constantly flying 10 feet above the ground around this entire theme park? Like, go up. Or go out over the ocean because you're actually endangering people.
Right.
And, you know, one of my major problems with Iron Man 2 is that just stuff happens because the script says it needs to happen as opposed to happening for a real reason.
Yeah.
And at one point, like 10 minutes into this action scene, Iron Man says to War Machine, we got to get these guys away from these people. And I'm going, just now this is occurring to you? You've been basically doing an ILM, you know, test reel for the last 10 minutes flying in and out of girders and understuff. You've been endangering people by just not leaving.
Right.
Yeah, it's ridiculous.
And so it happens on both sides. And again, it's always a matter of, you know, how many destroyed buildings is too many buildings? How many quips is too many quips? You know, how many sex scenes is too many sex scenes? And the difference between a great film and just a film is some artist at some point goes, nope, this is the, we're going to go right up to the cliff and then we're going to stop.
Stand there. Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly. And I think that, you know, that's why the Avengers is just, everybody loves it. And why Man of Steel, for as an impressive a production it is. And, you know, what was really funny was that summer, Henry Cavill,
mm-hmm.
was at San Diego Comic-Con, which I attend every year because I apparently pissed off a gypsy at one point. I have to. And I didn't go to the Warner Brothers party. I had an invite for my wife and myself, and we were just too exhausted. It was Friday night at San Diego. We just wanted to collapse. And I found out the next day from Dave Johnson, legendary comic artist, that Henry Cavill was at the Warner Brothers party walking around and not hanging out with the movie people. He was finding all of the DC Comics guys and asking them, how did we do?
Oh, wow. That's
like,
pretty cool.
You know, he was, you know, what a nice thing. He's actually like going to the comics people going, did you think we did a good job? And I thanked Christ and all his angels that I wasn't there because I have a very bad ability to lie to somebody's face.
Oh.
And I would have just looked at Henry Cavill and said, dude, I think you're fantastic. I think you're a great Superman. I can't wait to see you in a great Superman movie.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's true. I mean, I have hopes for Batman versus Superman, but I think it's going to be a dreary black and white moan fest.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if the advanced images we're seeing, you know, it's there's nothing of the, you know, there's nothing of this sort of like, you know, the joy of Superman versus the darkness of Batman. It just seems the morbidity of Superman versus the Batman. And, you know, I'll be there opening night. I'll be there first show. But it's very weird. They're very dark and they don't seem to be letting up on that.
Is it really surprising that the most powerful man in the world should be a figure of controversy?
We, as a population on this planet, have been looking for a savior.
We're talking about a being whose very existence,
they are not telling us the truth,
challenges our own sense of priority in the universe.
Human beings have a horrible track record of following people of great power.
Power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely.
Chaos.
Maybe he's just a guy trying to do the right thing.
We know better now, don't we?
Devils don't come from hell beneath us.
They brought their war here.
No, they come from the sky.
The world has been so caught up with what he can do that no one has asked what he should do.
Go on, go on, go on, go on.
That's how it starts. The fever, the rage, the feeling of powerlessness that turns good men cruel.
Batman films, my favorite of the Christopher Nolan Batman film is still the first one. Batman Begins. I love how that whole first half of the movie, you're so into that character, you forget in this character who's going around the world looking for the meaning of his soul. You kind of forget that, oh yeah, he kind of becomes Batman later, doesn't he? You're so involved in him. And I think that's important, that to make him interesting before he puts the costume on. So for me, that would be the most interesting and necessary aspect. And I that's why I kind of like Batman Begins would be my favorite of the...
Well, the only reason I think part two is better because Joker just elevates to another level.
Good Lord,
big fan of one also. And I wish three didn't exist because I can't. What the hell is this? Well, guys, I got to jump, unfortunately.
Yeah.
I could talk movies
thanks
all day.
So much. Yeah. Thank you so much for doing this, man. This is awesome.
You're welcome.
It's great to meet you. Yeah.
Very cool.
And well, great, Jim. Thank you.
All right, man. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right.
Time, Steve.
Thank
Take
you.
Care, man.
Take care. Bye.
I don't want all comic book adaptations to feel like the Marvel stuff. I thought Guardians of the Galaxy's certainly more sci-fi comedy rift and even Big Hero 6's at least tonal departure from the original source material were nice, very welcome alternates
from the Avengers Center type stuff. And you remember, after Shrek opened, any animated film which didn't have a hip, cynical, postmodern, God, I hate that freaking word or phrase, to them, were considered by many filmgoers and critics as not a good animated film, because with something like Shrek, they remembered the fun of blah, 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 blah. So a great movie like, say, Disney's Jules Verne-inspired Atlantis was clobbered by critics and even audiences for being too dark and serious. And forgive me, everyone, I really dug Man of Steel. Now, like you guys, I totally thought it went off the rails with that climactic battle. Like, what the, you know, way too much, too brutal, too barbaric, even maybe sadistic. However, we kind of are these days too, don't you think?
That's always a greater crime than a bad film, yeah. Is a mediocre film that had the DNA of a good flick.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's one of the reasons why people love a good awful film.
Mm-hmm.
Like a Plan 9 from Outer Space.
Sure.
You sit there, at no point was this ever in danger of being good. And the people making it are reveling in its awfulness. And you sit there and you just go, there's something about a golden turkey that is just glorious. But then when you see a movie, you're going, that actually could have been 3 stars. And nobody at any point was swinging for the fence.
Right, right. Yeah.
And I'm mixing my metaphors like a madman. I'm so sorry.
That all works. That all works. Yeah. I'm excited for Aquaman just in case he's able to redeem himself from Conan, because he was, you know, I 15 minutes into that thing, I had trouble with it.
Yeah.
And it was killing me, because I love that. That was one of my favorite characters growing up. I even begrudgingly liked the second Schwarzenegger movie.
Ooh.
You know? Mm-hmm. But no, just it was as far as, like, for me, one of the biggest failures of any comic movie was that thing stole from every other fantasy movie of the past 20 years except Conan. And there's a little bit of the King Arthur one with Clive Owen in there. There was a Lord of the Rings ripoff. So it was like anything that's had a sword in the past 20 or 25 years, they stole from it, except from the original Conan mythos.
I love when I'm able to sit there and go deep into a film that I know I should love.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not quite. And I love the fact that it's possible to go do research. You know, when the Star Wars prequels came out, I remember driving away from Phantom Menace with my friends, and we were just like, we were gobsmacked at how bad that thing was.
Yeah.
And my friends just started like going nuts. They were just like, I mean, they were complaining. They got to the point where they were complaining about alternating film grain. And I was just like, and I had this weird, you know, and I'm making air quotes, everything in life I learned from Star Wars moment. You know, the bit in Return of the Jedi where Luke uses the dark side to defeat Darth Vader, and he chops off Vader's sword hand and looks at the mechanical stump, and then he looks at his own hand and says, I am gazing into the abyss. I am becoming the monster.
Yeah.
And I looked at my friends complaining about the film grain in The Phantom Menace, and I went, oh my God, I'm becoming this. And I actually lost some friends over the next 6 years because I decided I was going to enjoy the little bits of the prequels that were pure Star Wars.
Yeah.
You know, that were good. And I felt like a Cubs fan or a Mets fan or like, you know, I was just like, we're never going to the World Series or the Super Bowl, but I'm always going to be there with my sad little pennant supporting the film.
Yeah.
And, you know, being able to, one of the things I did was like, I was like, well, why are these films different than the originals? Where did they go wrong? Why is the fourth Indiana Jones film, made by almost all the same people, different than the others? And when you're able to look at something like your favorite superhero film or your favorite comic book film, like, say, you know, a misfired Conan film, Conan's a tall redhead that hosts chat shows. you can sit there and go, why did that misfire? Why did that not work? Why was Iron Man great, but Iron Man 2, this weird, like, assortment of this laundry list of things that need to happen on the road to the Avengers, as opposed to being a good story unto itself. And I love doing the forensics. I love actually going, why did this – or one of the prime examples is whenever you adapt something from one medium to another. And since we're talking about movies here, it's adapting from comics or adapting from novels. And I know there have to be changes. And as I said earlier, it's the spirit of the thing. As long as the spirit, you know, transmits to the film version, it's okay to change. It's okay to combine characters and telescope time and all that other stuff. But when I see a story that's perfect and they change the story for the film version for no reason other than just it seems to be to change it. It's not like there was a budgetary restriction. It's not like this or that. I go, somebody already did the heavy lifting, dudes. Somebody figured out how to make this story work, and now you're unmaking it by taking the story away. And my prime example, that was the Watchmen film.
Okay.
And, and it's weird because I worked on the Watchmen film for 8 minutes.
Dude, you never told me that.
If you like, and people have heard me say this before, so any of my fans that hear me say this, they're going to always bringing this up again. It's my life, and I get to brag.
True.
After Zack Snyder was trying to get Watchmen greenlit by Warner Brothers, he was finishing up the last bits and pieces of 300. And I got contacted by his people saying, look, you know, they want a comic book artist. They want you to redesign 4 of the 6 Watchmen to show to the suits and ties at Warner Brothers, who have, you know, big desks and large cars and helicopters, but no imagination. And they want to show you this is what the final film will look like as opposed to the comic, which is the only thing they have to look at. And they said, we want you to do these 4 redesigns and then 4 cover quality illustrations of these redesigns so that we can use it in a pitch. And I was like, okay. So I actually had several conversations with Zack Snyder, who is a lovely guy, a fun guy. And he was sitting there talking and he was like, yeah, well, we know we kind of want Night Owl to be like Batman, the movie Batman. He needs to be more armor than tights. It's like, okay. And we want, you know, comedian to be more like this. And he had no ideas. I don't know what we're going to do with Silk Spectre. And I have friends who are cosplayers. I raised my hand and I said, latex.
Yep.
Just go with latex and you'll be friends. You'll have friends for life. And I did 5 or 6 sketches, which they approved. They said, okay, go ahead and do the finished pieces. And then I didn't hear from them for weeks and weeks and weeks. And I had regular deadlines like Catwoman covers and stuff like that. So I was like, okay, well, I'll put Watchmen aside, doing my thing. Then all of a sudden 300 came out. And 300 came out on a Friday, and on Monday Watchmen was greenlit. And I was like, I guess they didn't need my art. So that was my 8 minutes working on Watchmen. So I feel sometimes a little like am I betraying the people that paid me money by criticizing? But you know, one of the things where I felt let down by the Watchmen film, am I rambling, Craig?
Nope. Go crazy, babe.
Craig's known me for 30 years. He knows I will talk. Much like the Hellboy films, I was like, oh, well, you know, I'm sure they'll be able to capture the story, but they'll never capture the look. Mm. And they managed to capture the look, but not quite the story. And one of the things about Watchmen as a comic is it's about Ozymandias, who is going to destroy 1 million people to save the rest of the world. He's gonna sacrifice 1 million people to create a fake alien invasion that will spark the rest of the world to take their fingers off the nuclear missile launch buttons and band together. Mm-hmm. Amazing story. Alan Moore admitted that he borrowed it from an old, I think, was it Twilight Zone episode called Architects of Fear? I can't remember if it was Twilight Zone or Outer Limits.
Outer Limits, September 1963, less than a year after the actual Cuban Missile Crisis.
And it's a great plan, and it's a master plan. And one of the things in the Watchmen comic is you are stunned when you get to around issue 10 and you realize that the nicest guy in the book, Ozymandias, is the guy doing it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and the first mistake the film made was they cast creepy younger brother who pretty much was like the old Warner Brothers, you know, mad scientist with the neon sign, evil scientist, boo, yeah. evil yeah. scientist. Yeah. Boo. Like, you can tell Ozymandias is the bad guy. And you get to the end of the film and, you know, the Watchmen have to let him succeed, because if they don't, they realize they're going to undo what he's done. And it's one of the great sort of moral compromises. And the film missed the point of the comic, which was the comic presents this to the reader. Okay, the comic says, okay, you're one of the Watchmen. You have the chance to click with this and tell the world what this guy has done and undermine it, and we could probably have a nuclear war and those everybody will die. Or you could keep your mouth shut and be complicit in the murder of a million New Yorkers mm-hmm. and save the world.
Yeah.
And the two points of view are represented by Night Owl and Rorschach. Rorschach, mm-hmm. who does not compromise. Never, even in the face of Armageddon, which is his exact words, Night Owl's like, yeah, I guess we have to keep our mouths shut. And I remember reading that. I mean, I worked in a comic shop when that came out. I sold Watchmen to people, and I read that, and I was like, oh, I don't know what I would do. You know, and I found myself siding with Night Owl, going, yeah, sometimes you have to break a few eggs to make an omelet. And I had a friend who was like, no, Rorschach is right. Even if human civilization ends, you have to do what's morally right at all times. Mm-hmm. And I went, I don't think so. Right. And the film didn't do that. No. The film got to that point, and then Night Owl has a hissy fit and he starts bitch slapping. Why did you do it? No, you son of a bitch, blah. they did what I thought was unbelievably terrible, which is the comic presented a conundrum to its readers. And then did what the greatest mic drop in the history of graphic novels and comics and sequential art.
Yep.
The movie
right.
does your right. thinking for you. The movie Take says the no, yeah. no. You have to go on the side of this is wrong. Mm-hmm. We painted Ozymandias as a bad guy from his first scene, and in the last scene, the heroes are all naughty boy. You're bad. Mm-hmm. And I was like going, you missed the entire point. This is a $200 million. Oops. And that's the part that bugged me the most. And I would tell people, like, yeah, I had a problem with the ending. And they're like, oh, are you mad because they didn't do the giant squid? Mm. And I was a little pissed off because here's an R-rated movie where they have the world's most uncomfortable sex scene. And I'm sorry.
It was.
My prom night was way more glamorous than that fuck with the world's worst version of Hallelujah playing. Our theater was laughing their asses off. And you're supposed to be going, this is a guy overcoming impotence, and this is a glorious romantic moment. And people at our theater were almost throwing popcorn. They were crying, laughing so hard. And you've end of Watchmen, the comic. I remember just sitting there going, I've never seen this in my life. Right. I've never. Right. This is the most shocking set of visuals ever. And then in the movie, what you get is what we used to call the Praxis wave, you know, from Star
yep.
Trek 6.
Right.
The Praxis
right.
goes up, and all of a sudden, for no reason, in the special edition of Star Wars, the Death Star has the
Praxis.
The Death
Praxis Star has wave. It too. Yeah.
And it's like, so, you know, we've got a hard R-rated movie that has uncomfortable sex and compound fractures and F words and blah, 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 blah. And we get to what should be the gut-wrenching finale, and we have a G-rated USA Network special effect.
Yeah.
And there isn't nary a dead body in sight. So the end has no emotional impact whatsoever. They've missed the point of the story. They've missed the emotional solar plexus yeah. punch.
Yeah.
And I was going, this is – you know – the heavy lifting of Watchmen had been done for you. All you had to do was figure out how to make it work visually and in a sequential, not a sequential, but a cinematic form. And that's where I find that, and it's like any other adaptation. This is not exclusive to superhero or comic book adaptations. I'm always amazed when a good film gets made, when I see about the amount of hurdles and difficulties that have to be overcome for a film to get made. When a great one comes out, I'm like, this is like the harmonic convergence. This must happen once every 10,000 years.
Yeah.
But it's a balancing act. And when something like Iron Man or Dark Knight or Winter Soldier gets made, as a comics fan and a cinema fan, I'm sitting there and going, wow, both sides of me are just awash in satisfaction. I rambled. I went and talked. Craig's going to have fun editing the shit out of that.
I'm not going to edit too much of that. That was too good.
Cool.
Yeah. That was too good. A rant. That was just too damn good. All right. An intelligent.
Well, it also pretty much nails the coffin lid shut on me ever working with Zack Snyder again. Well, I think he's a great guy, and I think he's an amazing visual talent.
I loved everything you were saying about Watchmen. I kind of want to go back and watch it again and just be even more disappointed now.
Hey, I'm free for a part two anytime in the future if you guys want to.
Awesome.
Take care, Jim.
All right, you too. See ya.
You too, sir.
Bye.
Oh man, that was just too awesome, too cool, too much fun. What more can you add?
Can you dig it? Can you dig it? Can you dig it?
I guess just one more thing. And that's the warrior Cyrus reminding us that it's time for our Do You Dig It or Not Dig It film review. And as this special edition, this special DocuPod episode of The Grindhouse with Craig and Jim was initiated by the hype surrounding Avengers Age of Ultron, why don't we review Avengers Age of Ultron?
This could have been avoided if you hadn't played with something you don't understand.
I'm sorry. It is funny. It's a hoot that you don't get why we need
this. Tony, maybe this might not be the time.
Really? That's it. You just roll over, show your belly every time somebody snarls.
Only when I've created a murder bot.
We didn't. We weren't even close. Were we close to an interface?
Well, you did something right. And you did it right here. The Avengers were supposed to be different than S.H.I.E.L.D.
Anybody remember when I carried a nuke through a wormhole?
No, it's never come up.
Save
no,
New York?
Never heard that.
Recall that? A hostile alien army came charging through a hole in space. We're standing 300 feet below it. We're the Avengers. We can bust arms dealers all the live long day, but that up there, that's the end game. How are you guys planning on beating that? Together.
Avengers Age of Ultron, in a nutshell, yeah, I dug it. Big time, however, with a couple of reservations. Interestingly, this time around, I mean, like I said, I dug the film. This time around, I felt it felt more like a very good comic book movie, whereas the first film, to me, felt more like just a very good movie. And I don't mean just by the degree of CGI, which in this kind of movie is somewhat necessary. There are just some things you just can't do practically. But I'm talking about tone. And a nice example might be, I think the first Avengers film was a little more layperson friendly, whereas this time around, you kind of have to know a little bit about the Marvel Universe in order to fully appreciate it. I actually went to the film with a good friend. Her name is Cindy Fautit. She's actually one of the contributors to the Gold Cottage online magazine. She's written a few articles. She's going to be one of the hosts of one of our online TV shows. And she enjoys the Marvel films, but she is not familiar with all of the backstory to all of the characters. And there were a few times she got a little lost. Afterwards, we had like some pizza and we were sitting and chatting, and I was kind of filling in some of the blanks, so to speak. So I would say this film is definitely a little more of a clubhouse or members only, for lack of a better term, film than the first film was. Now, something that I really loved about the first film, which I think this film did very well. The first film, as we mentioned before, in fact, we mentioned it earlier in this show, should not have worked. Too many characters, too sprawling, too much plot, too much subplot. But somehow Joss Whedon winnowed it all down and structured it in the format of that Robert Aldrich film that we said. And that's not an easy thing to do.
I think this film does that as successfully. I think it really, it introduces a few more characters, and both narratively and geographically, kind of goes to a few places bordering, you know, in lesser hands, it could have been too sprawling, too many places. But what I really dug, and I'm trying to mention this quickly and try not to get too bogged down in it, but it's an important concept. Before the movie started, there were these trailers for a couple of movies. Selfless with Ryan Gosling and Ben Kingsley. San Andreas with Dwayne The Rock Johnson. And I was sitting there watching the preview for Selfless, and it's like, my God, this is just a ripoff of John Frankenheimer's Second, a modern-day ripoff.
Mm-hmm.
And then yeah. San Andreas, hey, it's Earthquake without Charlton Heston. And then last year we had Into the Storm, which was pretty much a retread of Twister.
Right.
I mean, Twister. Almost a carbon mm-hmm. copy of Twister. And there seems yeah. to be a trend right now in films where, hey, let's just do a new CGI souped-up version of a classic old film because enough time has passed where there's a whole younger generation not familiar with the original, so we can get away with it. And to me, it feels like they're saying the audience won't notice. So that I can't stand. What I love about what Joss Whedon did in the first film, kind of structuring it like a Robert Aldrich film, this time around, and I'm sure you probably picked up on this too, partway into the film, I was like, oh, wow, he's doing Colossus, the Forbin Project. And then a little later, oh, with a little bit of demon seed tossed in there, too. And I like what I love about what Joss Whedon does, and this is, I think, the film's strongest point for me, of course. It's all very subjective, was he's very good. I think a lot of the newer films like Selfless and San Andreas and Into the Storm, they're kind of pouring stale old wine into new wineskins and trying to pass it off and hope you don't notice the vinegary flavor. Whereas what Joss Whedon does, he takes fresh new wine and pours it into older wineskin, and kind of like the way that when wine ages, it'll pick up some of the flavor of the barrels that it's in. I think he mm-hmm. does that. He pours a fresh new story into an old classic Hollywood genre wineskin, picks up some of that flavor to remind you that this isn't... You know, he brings a new high-tech film and makes it feel like an old-school classic kind of film.
In a nutshell, I 100% dug it. Not 100%, okay. But 88% dug it. Let's go with that.
Okay.
I got to tell you, from the opening sequence, I was actually a little down on it, and I had like, oh boy, my optimism is crashing. It's going to become more cautious now because, as you mentioned, it's CGI earlier. That first sequence, that first action yeah. sequence before the title even comes up is really muddled, and it felt like I'm watching a video game with faces superimposed yeah. on it. And first thing I thought of, man, Blade 2. Because, Blade 2 has a great story, but there's a few fights in Blade 2 that feel it totally feels like, you know, I'm watching a 1997-era graphics Mortal Kombat fight, you know, where it's right. total side-by-side, you know. And, yeah, it was distracting. I was like, oh, my God, I hope the whole thing doesn't feel like this, where I don't even feel like it's touched by human hands.
Mm-hmm.
And perfectly, no, it doesn't. That opening fight is the worst example of this, and then every fight after that gets a little better and a little better.
Yeah.
And, you know, I kind of had this problem with the Last Avengers and with the entire Transformers series and a lot of, you know, overly CGI movies these days, Avatar, where there's just so much crap on the screen, you can't tell what's what anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And you and I have talked about action sequences before, and one of the ones I always fall back on is Cross of Iron with Sam Peckinpah, like that mm-hmm. last, I don't know, most people haven't had a chance to see it, but it's a forgotten gem to anybody under 40 yeah. or even 50.
Right.
But there's this perfect end sequence. Soldiers being led across a minefield while receiving fire from their own side and the enemy behind them. So you're basically, there's danger below, danger on either side of you, and just like things exploding everywhere, but Sam Peckinpah shot it, and you know that you can look at it and know that he planned everything way in advance. He knew where every shot was going to fit with every other next shot. This one, there was rhyme and reason, and each shot, as quick as they were, I felt that there was very few moments where something didn't feel entirely organic to me. Like, it just really swept along in a way that the modern James Bonds do. Another thing, my immediate reaction as soon as this movie was over, and it kind of goes back to something that you and I said, you and Steve and I said, and you and Adam and I have said all within this show, when we've all touched on just the sheer level of destruction and unseen bloodshed, this movie, I think, off the top of my head, and maybe if I have another week to think about it, I'll revise this, but my immediate reaction is I can't remember another big comic adaptation in the past, Jesus, since Batman Begins, maybe, where there's such an attempt and such a focus on saving lives.
I agree. That did come to mind watching that final sequence.
It's the same level of property damage, but there's even, you know, there's that great bit where you know, they've cleared just about an entire building, but through the suit, Iron Man can tell that there are three people still in an entire apartment building. He knows there's three people who didn't get out, and he goes into the apartment and he rescues them, you know?
Yeah.
And, that kind of tells me that, okay, not only did they just drop that whole building the way they have been doing for a lot of movies lately, but this time he actually knew people were in there. Mm-hmm. And that was just, I got to tell you, I got a big lump in my throat in that scene that they actually, it's almost like they've heard this criticism from enough critics and they're, yeah, you know what, these guys aren't heroes if they can't do that.
Can you dig it?
You gotta be fucking kidding.
Nope, sorry we're not. That's Palmer from The Thing, disappointed that another show's come to an end. I feel you, dude. But wow, we certainly packed a lot into this one for what I think rates as a damn fine season opener. And while we maybe surpassed our original 1 hour show estimate by a good half hour, it definitely moved along at a nice clip. Didn't really drag any. And big time thanks to both Adam Hughes and Stephen P. Wegner for making that happen. By coming in with a bucket load of fascinating topics to discuss, and possessing the wit and intelligence to get them across in brisk and entertaining fashion. Thanks so much, guys. Well, that'll about do it for this one, and also thanks so much once again to our listeners for tuning in. We trust you're glad you did. I'm Craig Jameson of Gull Cottage Online.
And I'm Jim Delaney of TheLunchMovie.com.
And thanks for joining us at the Grindhouse. Meet you again real soon. Up there in those cheap seats where all the real fun goes down. Later.
Oh. Someday I'll find out what that means.